I'm Kate Remington, and today I'm talking with composer Augusta Reed Thomas. She's celebrating her 50th birthday in a big way with a performance Thursday evening at 7:30 in Woolsey Hall, New Haven, with the New Haven Symphony Orchestra. And Augusta, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you, Kate.
You know, the 50th anniversary seems to be a pretty big deal, 50th birthday, and you're certainly in good company. Sibelius celebrated. It was a national holiday in Finland, apparently. And I'm curious about how you worked with William at the orchestra to decide which pieces would be on this wonderful program.
Well, thank you. And first, I should really extend my gratitude to William Boughton and the New Haven Symphony Orchestra for this amazing opportunity. I feel very blessed and lucky and fortunate indeed. The idea for this concert was entirely William's idea, as a matter of fact. I remember when he had called me and said he was going to do a 50th birthday concert, I was a little shy about it because I think maybe I'm supposed to be 70 or 80 before one would celebrate my birthday, but it was really incredibly generous of him. And the program was put together largely by William, actually. He had wanted to repeat a piece that he'd done when I was their composer in residence from 2009 to 2011, and the piece is entitled Absolute Ocean for soprano and orchestra with a harp obbligato. And in this case, the soprano soloist will be Tony Arnold. And then we had the good fortune to be able to collaborate on the new saxophone concerto, which is entitled Hempke Concerto with the subtitle Prisms of Light. That is a work which Fred Hempke's students commissioned in honor of him when he was retiring from a multi-decade year career of teaching. So they approached me about the possibility of receiving the commission in honor of Fred Hempke, and of course I was thrilled and delighted and honored, but we didn't have an orchestra. Of course, we just had the fact that they were commissioning me to write a piece. And at that point, William was kind enough to say that he would be happy to do the world premiere of the saxophone concerto. And also, as you may know, we're recording the whole concert for a release on Nimbus Alliance CD.
That is big, big news. All of those things are really wonderful because, for one thing, it seems as though very often an orchestra will play a piece by a living composer, and that's it. You never get a chance to hear the work again. And so I think it's really wonderful that the New Haven Symphony is performing Absolute Ocean again, and also, of course, the world premiere. Does it ever get old hearing your work performed by an orchestra for the very first time?
It's extremely exciting. One works, as you know, for months and months and months. The saxophone concerto took me 8 months to compose. It's a 20-minute work with lots of different character and moods. And the opportunity to have a great orchestra such as the New Haven Symphony, and of course William is a fabulous conductor and marvelous soloist in terms of Tony Arnold and also Fred Hempke on the saxophone concerto. You know, it's really a thrill. It's a very, very beautiful chance for composers when we get to hear our works and we get to hear them well played and with a sympathetic audience. It's incredibly meaningful.
Well, it must be quite different from, obviously, there's all kinds of software now that allows you to hear a piece as you're writing it or as you've finished a particular passage. But yeah, there's nothing like hearing it performed by real live people. And I understand from the way you work that you actually sing the pieces that you're writing, singing the little snippets, and in some cases dancing along. And I love that image, and I know that there's a real concrete reason why you do that.
That's right. I feel that, for myself anyway, it's very important to physicalize my sounds. What will the musicians be doing? How will they be playing? How much air do they need? What will the bow arm be doing? What kind of vibrato do I want, and so on and so forth. So I tend to be very detail-oriented in my notations. Every note has an articulation, a dynamic, often an adjective. The pieces are very sculpted and carefully nuanced in every dimension. And part of getting to that kind of nuance is by physicalizing the work. So if you were to come to my studio, I actually stand up when I compose, and I have large drafting tables and piano, and I usually improvise and sing and actually literally dance the rhythms, trying to feel exactly how they feel. I conduct my music at home also. I go through the whole score many, many times. And, of course, I'm a terrible conductor and a terrible dancer and a terrible singer on top of it all. But just really being in touch with the sounds is very important. And I hope that when people hear my music, that they can really hear that I heard it and felt it, that it hopefully sounds musical or inevitable or natural.
Well, I'm curious about how much of that, the intention of the notes, how much of that actually ends up in the manuscript? I mean, what kind of directions do you give to the players then once you've kind of lived through this music?
That's a really good question. On the manuscript, I write, of course, all the pitches. There's no pitches that are left for improvisation. I also write all the rhythms, exact rhythms, and articulations, whether it's accented or dotted or slurred. These articulations make such a difference when you're having, let's say, 80 musicians all be playing together. They need to articulate in the right way. And then I am very careful about dynamics. And I try to also give a sense of the gestalt or the inner life of a line. So I might write playful or capricious or with great fanfare or majestic or suddenly interior or something like that, so that the players, when they see their notes on the page, they kind of know the mood I'm going for. It's quite interesting also because the comment I get so often, almost every day of my life, is musicians writing me saying, thank you for your adjectives. They're fabulous. I know just what you want. And it's really fun to be able to try to tell the player what kind of color you're going for.
Well, that is really fascinating because so often musicians, you know, you get the standard Italian markings for tempo and that sort of thing. But other than that, there's really not a lot there. So it must be, as you say, really refreshing for a musician to get so much direction. And then, of course, the advantage is, too, if they're a little unclear, they can just contact you. You can't do that with Beethoven or Brahms anymore. So that's another really wonderful collaboration, I guess, with working with a living composer.
Yeah, I try to make it so that the scores are very, very clear. And one hopes, in the purest sense of the notation working, is that no one has any questions, that it's just clear. And if I tell my students, if you can go through a whole week of orchestral performances and nobody asks you a question of any kind, that meant you did a really good job of being super clear of what you wanted. Because some composers arrive and everybody's standing in line. What did you mean here? What did you mean there? How about this? What about that? And so on and so forth. So I prefer to interact with the musicians about the music itself and the meaning of the sound, or to have a real conversation about the repertoire rather than to have to spend our time cleaning up notations that should have been taken care of months ago.
Several of the works on the program, including Absolute Ocean, are settings that you've done of poems by E.E. Cummings. And I'm wondering what it is about his poetry in particular that really gets your creativity flowing.
In the past 30 years, I've written a lot of vocal music. And usually I'm setting the texts of great or famous poets. And one of the things that attracts me to the poems of E.E. Cummings is their beautiful imagery, also the sense that the words leave room for other things to enter. He uses a lot of spaces and dashes, or not exactly dashes, he hardly uses punctuation, but he uses dashes in the sense that he'll cut a line in half and it'll drop word by word down the page like raindrops on the page. Those kinds of things really make you feel like you could add music to the imagery and that it would make sense, so that one being poetry plus one being music doesn't just add up to two, but that it can actually multiply and bloom and suddenly add up to 28 or something. So with Cummings, with the two songs that I wrote for the young girls, the Elm City Girls Chorus, I set some poems that I thought would appeal to young musicians. Some of the girls singing are only age 9 and 10, for instance. And so there's a certain sense of playfulness. The sky is candy, edible pink spry, you know, locomotives are spouting violets, and just whimsical, beautiful, fun pictures that are part of the Cummings poem that I set, for instance. In Absolute Ocean, I picked three poems. They're again, very characteristically coming, some whim and some seriousness, some abstraction. And I find them all very conducive to setting.
Well, what I love about the settings in Absolute Ocean in particular is the shimmering quality that you've included in the orchestration and the harp, too. It's just a kind of a scintillating sound that really, I think, works so well with the imagery. The moon is mentioned in the poems many times, and it's just a really incredible sound world.
You're absolutely right, Kate. And for instance, in the first song of Absolute Ocean, the image is that the moon is hiding in her hair. The lily of heaven, full of all dreams, draws down. Cover her briefness in singing. You know, these kinds of very sensuous, you know, the moon is hiding in her hair and the lily of heaven and dreams and singing and, you know, all these beautiful images. I was trying to capture that mood in the music. In the second movement, it's very whimsical and funny, which is, who knows if the moon's a balloon coming out of a keen city in the sky filled with pretty people? And if you and I should get into it, if they should take me and take you into their balloon, well, then we'd go up higher with all the pretty people. And it goes on and on. It was just silly and fun, almost like a pitter-patter song.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference, again, in character between one Cummings poem and the next, really, I found very inspiring as I created this large work, which has a duration of about 20 minutes.
And it's a wonderful, there's a variety too, because there is also just an interlude for harp and orchestra, and so it all works together so well. And Augusta, it's going to be a wonderful evening, and I'm so grateful that you could spend a little time talking about it and about the music, and happy birthday.
Oh, well, Kate, I want to thank you so much for including me on your fabulous show, and also just to say that it's such a thrill to be back in New Haven working with this orchestra. These musicians have performed a lot of my music over the years, as you know, and I'm particularly grateful to them for their excellence, and also to William Boughton, who has conducted more of my music than anyone else, and I'm eternally grateful to him for his belief and support of my life's work.